This is the Heartland Collegiate Compendium. The legal and regulatory environment of business. Lecture 4, delivered on June 11th of 2008. The title of this lecture is The Constitution and Due Process.
Tonight, I finish the topic of constitutional law, and then, provided there is time, I will move on to contracts. A couple of matters, tying down a couple of matters from my last lecture. One of them has to do with commercial speech and limits on commercial speech. Generally speaking, as I told you before, commercial speech is now recognized as having constitutional protection, not as much as individual speech. The Supreme Court recognizes first that commercial speech does have some protection, but that the federal government may regulate commercial speech more than it may regulate individual speech. The Supreme Court has set forth a test, and it is generally referred to as the Central Hudson Test. You'll hear me call it just the Hudson Test. The Hudson Test arising from the case of that name, Hudson, Central Hudson. Essentially, here is the test that the Supreme Court uses with respect to commercial speech. First of all, the commercial speech must be lawful and not misleading. That qualifies it for protection. If the commercial speech is lawful and not misleading, it qualifies for protection under the United States Constitution. That's just the qualification. That doesn't mean automatically it's protected. What goes on from there is that if the government proceeds to regulate this lawful and non-misleading speech, the government regulation must be pursuant to an interest that is, quote, substantial, end quote. So if the government is going to regulate lawful, non-misleading commercial speech, the government must first of all have a substantial interest in the content of that commercial speech. Having done that, having established that it has a substantial interest, the government must then show that the regulation of this lawful, non-misleading speech directly advances that interest the state has, that substantial interest the state has. And the same interest cannot be advanced by less intrusive regulation. I'll let you get that down, and then let me walk you through this. Commercial speech with respect to let's say with respect to a laundry detergent. We have a law that requires that forbids a manufacturer of laundry detergent from saying that the laundry detergent makes clothes cleaner than clean. If you're not allowed to say that. Okay. Now, let's look at the first part of this. Is it unlawful to say that clothes are cleaner than clean? No. No, don't take a businessman's approach or a businesswoman's approach. Absolutely not. Come on. Okay. Is it misleading to say that the clothes are cleaner than clean? Now, here, you ask yourself, is there a moron who actually believes that you can make things cleaner than clean? The answer is, well, maybe there are some people like that. People who live in Decatur, perhaps. But other than that, oh, I'm sorry, I shouldn't do that. I pick on Decatur, and sooner or later, every class, someone says, my mom's from Decatur. Yes, of course, she is, son. What I'm trying to get to here is, it's not misleading to say cleaner than clean, because you shouldn't believe that there is something cleaner than clean. Let's get that out of the way. Okay, now, does the government have a substantial interest in keeping people from hearing that clothes are cleaner than clean? Does the government have a substantial interest? Right there. Hudson Test says regulation's unconstitutional. Okay, let's get past that one and say somehow, in some bizarre universe, we can say that the government has a substantial interest in people not hearing that clothes can be cleaner than clean with a detergent. Okay, we got past that. Now, we say, does this rule advance, this regulation, advance the interest the government has, the substantial interest the government has in keeping people from hearing that clothes can be cleaner than clean with this detergent? Well, probably so. I mean, it simply says you can't say they're cleaner than clean, so it does directly advance the interest. And would there be any lesser regulation, any other way that's not as intrusive on the speech to get this, to keep companies from saying cleaner than clean? Well, probably not. That would be the way you would do it, is to forbid them from saying it. Okay? You might figure there might be another way so that they, but probably no. If we can buy into the argument that the government has a substantial interest in keeping companies from telling people that clothes can be cleaner than clean with a detergent, then this regulation certainly directly addresses the interest, and this regulation is about as minimal as you can get to deal with that. You could say, well, they could say, well, the regulation could say, they can't say anything about clean. Well, that would be overbroad. Certainly, you can make a law, a regulation that would be narrower. And so that's why Hudson Test talks about the narrowest possible regulation that will advance the interest of the state in this regard. So keep that in mind when you're advertising. The Hudson Test gives you protection, but you, from a business person's point of view, first of all have to say, is my ad lawful? Am I selling something that's lawful? And am I saying something about the use of that's lawful? And then, am I being misleading in this ad? And that doesn't mean, am I lying? Lying is not the issue. Are you substantially misleading people by what you are saying about this? If you were to say, eating our cereal will make you slimmer, you're playing there. You might be misleading. But if you say, this cereal is part of a healthy diet, then you're not misleading. Okay? Notice how you play with the language. And then you say, okay, now, has the government ever tried to show successfully that it has a substantial interest in saying things like this? Okay, that would be your next, okay? And if there have been cases like that, you look to see if the regulation directly addresses what you're saying and all of that, okay? So it's multi-point, but from a business practical perspective, you need to say, am I doing something lawful? Am I promoting lawful activity or lawful products and lawful uses of those products? And then from there, am I being misleading with what I am saying? If you can answer, yes, I am being lawful in what I am saying, and I am promoting lawful activities with my products, and I am not being misleading, you're in at least in the ballpark of being able to go ahead with what you are saying about your products. Okay, keep that in mind. You don't have to be a professional in advertising to advertise your small company. You just have to be a little careful about what you say. Now, let me revisit just briefly the Fourth Amendment to go into the important matter of the exclusionary rule. The Fourth Amendment most decidedly, clearly, states that you are protected from unreasonable searches and seizures. You are secure. And that security may be breached only when the state has, by written affirmation, oath, that kind of thing, gotten a court to narrow your rights with respect to a specific place and matter. Now, I'll get into this a little more in a minute, but I'll point out right here. That has been eroded, especially in the past 5 years, maybe fewer years. The Supreme Court is finding more excuses for making exceptions to that rule. Moreover, the FBI has been involved in using national security letters to simply go in and do whatever they want without getting court orders, on the premise that surely we're just looking for things that are unlawful activities, even though the number of national security letters issued is simply staggering. Many people I know have probably been the subject of a national security letter. Many people. I have every reason to believe that I have been the subject of a national security letter. Here's the bad thing about national security letters. The person who is receiving the national security letter, requiring the divulgence of information about, let us say, you, is by law prohibited from ever telling you that the national security letter was received. So when the FBI wants to know what we have read here at this college, they will issue a national security letter ordering the disgorgement of all records on the computers here, all records of books checked out here. And the library officials and the school officials are prohibited from ever telling you that this happened. This is also true with banks. Banks receive literally tens of thousands of national security letters, some of them for individuals, some of them just blanket. They have no court backing. The FBI simply says, it is on our good faith that we are issuing this because we are the good guys. We never lie. We always just look for the truth. Just the facts, ma'am. Did you know this? These have been going on. Actually, national security letters have been around for quite a few years, but they were very rarely used. Only in major cases where they didn't want the bad guys to find out that they were watching or trying to get a look at them. Now they're being used on everyone. Internet service providers receive national security letters all the time. That means that internet service providers are giving the FBI every bit of information about you, and me, looking for anything that we might be doing that might be illegal. So, we would be interested, for example, have you gone to a website where there were pictures of underage girls? You haven't. Well, are you going to be sure that when they get those records, they won't find something?
They shouldn't.
They shouldn't? How do you know that? Do you know that I can spoof an IP? Do you know what spoofing is?
No.
I can reproduce your IP and then go looking anywhere I want. And it will be you that did it. They could be going after you to see if you happen to have been going to any terrorist websites, or if you've been researching nuclear weapons development, or biological weapons development. They might be interested in that kind of thing about you. They might, in your bank records, look to see if you have gotten any unusual patterns of money coming and going, to see if maybe you're getting money for a terrorist act later. All of this can be done now. This is a great big giant gaping asshole in the Fourth Amendment. The courts are sitting there back letting this happen. The number of national security letters has risen exponentially in the past 5 years. to the point now where even the Inspector General of the FBI, one of their inspectors, said the FBI had gone completely overboard and was using using completely ridiculous excuses just to go on fishing expeditions. Has that stopped them? Probably not. We don't know because we can't find out who the national security letters have been issued on because that's a secret. My favorite story is a friend of mine who runs a conspiracy website where he tells about, you know, rumors and conspiracy theories about 9/11, stuff like that, government intrigue, complete conspiracy. I love the guy. He runs his own website and his own server, so he doesn't use a web host for it. He actually got a national security letter ordering that he disclose information about the person running the website. Well, he runs the website, but it's his server. So the national security letter gave him the usual language. You, under federal law, under penalty of federal law, severe penalty it is, you are not allowed to disclose to this website owner that you have disclosed this information about him. So this guy had effectively gotten a letter telling him that he couldn't tell himself about the national security letter. He just had a ball with it. He just had fun. He actually posted the story on his website. Just hilarious that the government actually ordered him not to tell himself about the warrantless search warrant, as it is sometimes called, national security letters. Just keep that in mind. When you read this flowery language about our Fourth Amendment, remember that it is under siege. This isn't the first time in history it's happened. It's happened before. They scare people into giving up rights in the name of security, and people, through a combination of fear and ignorance of how far they're going, let it happen. Okay, the exclusionary rule. The exclusionary rule. Evidence that is collected with a defective warrant or with a warrant that does not exist must be excluded from evidence in trial. And evidence that derives from illegally collected evidence must be excluded in trial. That is what is called the fruit of the poison tree doctrine. If the tree is poison, then the fruit from that tree is poison. If the search was done illegally, then the product of that search is inadmissible as evidence. It is fruit of a poison tree. If I do certain things wrong in an interrogation of you, and as a result of those wrong things, I obtain evidence. That evidence may be excluded in trial because it is fruit of a poison tree. Now, there are exceptions to the requirement of a warrant, other than these national security letters, which these conservative, almost right-wing authors of this book happened to just twinkle toe around. They knew damn well these were going on, and they didn't even bother to mention them in this book. But there are exceptions other than national security letters. For example, if you are under arrest or placed under arrest, then certainly a search of your person, even in the absence of a warrant, is allowed. There's no question about that. No question about that. Another place where a warrant would not necessarily be required would be where obtaining a warrant would be impractical given the urgency of a situation or given the nature of a situation. So, for example, if you heard screams in a house, you were a police officer, you heard screams, "Don't kill me," you could certainly have a very decent argument that it was acceptable, legal, to break into that house without a warrant because of the impending nature of a crime. Those are traditional. The Supreme Court has been expanding, unfortunately, as the Supreme Court has drifted from center to conservative to the right, and now is fully in a right-wing mode. It has expanded this like you're on a slippery slope. For example, traffic stops. Case was, it was out of Illinois. The gentleman was named Cabayas. He was stopped on a traffic stop. A second officer who happened to have a drug-sniffing dog shows up, brings a dog, and dog smells marijuana in the trunk. Trunk is open. There is, sure enough, $250,000 worth. The exclusionary rule was applied at trial because it was a warrantless search. I believe it was a... No, I'm sorry. He was convicted at trial. That's right. And then at appeal, at the circuit court level, or at the appeals level, I'm sorry, it was kicked out saying the marijuana was the result of a warrantless search, and it was an unwarranted warrantless search. The Supreme Court of the United States held in a 5-4 decision, notice that bare majority, that, oh, that's okay because you have no reasonable expectation of privacy if you are doing something illegal, which was the case here. Yeah.
If the dog indicating it's marijuana, that would be probable cause.
There is an interesting thing. The dog was being allowed to sniff on the suspicion of illegal activity. But the dog himself, and this gets to a really basic argument. I don't want to trivialize this, but how would you like to spend 25 years in prison because of a dog? That's what this is all about. The damn dog is essentially the commencement of a chain of accusations. The dog produces the suspicion. A dog. This goes to other ideas too now, where these machines, as I had told you last time, we're coming to a time now when machines will be able to scan you as you drive by. And they'll be able to tell if you're using drugs, what you have in your system. It's not going to be a person that will have created the chain of accusation. It will be a damn machine, a senseless machine will have started the chain of events that eventually ends your right to privacy. That is scary. That's very scary. When we have machines and dogs that can cause human beings to go to prison. Now, that sounds like a far-fetched concept, but there are some very important legal scholars, civil libertarians, who say, this is all wrong. This is wrong when we are using animals and technology to make people go away for years and years and years. I'm glad you brought that up. There is an issue there. And it will get worse and worse as the years go by, unless there is a major social sea change, unless people become more aware of it. It will really be the case within easily 5 years. You'll be scanned. As you go along the highway, you'll be scanned. If you've been using drugs, they'll get you. In fact, it might be the case that they'll get you even if you weren't using drugs, because it is well known, well established, that if you eat poppy seed bagels and things with poppy seeds, you will test positive for opiates. You will. That's the reality of it. Okay? And there are other things that can happen too. Tests can run positive for the use of tetrahydrocannabinol, the active ingredient in marijuana. Even if you have never used marijuana, you can show up positive for it. There are other diseases that can make you show up positive for certain drugs. And so you could end up being stopped, being arrested, and having to prove that you're innocent just because a machine said you were guilty. That's what's coming. And like I said, it's scary. Another part of this is that the Supreme Court, and this is old tradition, has looked to balance privacy rights against rights, not rights, against compelling interests of the state. Great example of this, as is described in the book, is with respect to drug testing. In the case of a high school student, Earls, her name was, who had actually very reputable kid. I mean, just a great student, good athlete. Her school district decided to impose a drug testing program, urinalysis program. She was furious. You are presuming guilt, essentially. Testing me, testing anyone really, without probable cause. You have no probable cause to test me. If you had probable cause, if I were behaving in a manner consistent with drug use or something of that nature, certainly there could be grounds for a test, for a search of your person at the level of your body fluids, for God's sake. Well, sure, maybe you could get a warrant. However, a drug testing program is a prior assumption of guilt. There is no probable cause involved. Circuit Court of Appeals agreed with her. Oh yeah, you're right. Bingo. 5-4 decision, U.S. Supreme Court. The interest of the state in keeping high school kids from sucking drugs is much more important than high school students' privacy rights. End of case. Yeah, they can test you. Yeah, they can test you. No need to prove, no need to establish even a suspicion, even a hint of suspicion. Just by virtue of the fact that you choose to be in athletics, you will be tested. You will be tested. And then, of course, you have the argument, well, if you don't want to be tested, then just don't be in sports. Ah, so that's the way it works now, is that in order to not surrender my right to privacy, I must surrender my right to free association. She passed. I mean, the kid was so straight. I mean, you're talking about one of those clean-cut kids. I mean, the kid probably didn't even have any trans fats in her blood.
When my school started the drug testing policy, my high school, it went, I don't know, it was 3 years while I was in there, and at least another three that I remember, there still hasn't been anybody except tested positive.
And, you know, it's funny about that. Yeah, you'll catch stupid once in a while with one of these drug tests. But in general, you will catch people. And the whole point of it is not to catch people with drugs. It's to tell you who's the boss, to show the authoritarian nature of the society. It's like, I mean, there was a community college where I taught. And right after I finished teaching there, they instituted mandatory drug testing of professors. And what? You know, I didn't realize that drug-crazed professors were the scourge of the, you know, of the college system. You know, maybe we're talking about them taking too many sleeping pills, putting kids to sleep in class, but other than that, I mean, it's perfectly legal though. A compelling state interest in keeping state employees from being in, under the influence of drugs on the job. Do you see how they're reaching for a compelling state interest? Come on! You know, you're talking about professors, boring human beings who maybe in their youth they used some drugs, but, you know, that was 30 years ago before they turned into boring people who wear Dockers. But this is where we are now. This is where we are now. The question is, and I have written on this subject, are we going to be moving more and more towards this, or are we going to find a way to draw the line, not just say no more, but to draw the line and say let's get back from this? And there are consequences either way. Yeah, kids use drugs. Kids are stupid. But at the same time, does it require that we take away everyone's privacy rights to deal with the stupidity of the few? Or the many, as it is. It's an issue that I do not want to explore in this class too far. It's something that you'll have to choose to deal with on your own. Let me touch upon, the Fifth Amendment. A lot of people think about the Fifth Amendment for the right against self-incrimination. It recognizes that you have the right not to incriminate yourself. Let me point out that the Fifth Amendment has a very big, big other clause, has a big, big other section, eminent domain, takings clause. The government may take your property, but if it does, it must justly compensate you for doing so. It may take your property for public purpose, but if it is going to do that, it must provide you with fair compensation. So they can take your house away if they need to put in a road. They could do that. But if they're going to, they have to give you what your house is worth and what your aggravation is worth. They can't just take it and give you $10 and say, here's your damn money. They have to do it right. Now, with respect to commercial takings, the taking has to deny you substantially all of the economic value of your commercial property. Okay, so you can't say, well, the government put a traffic light out there, and that's making the people more difficult for people to come to my store. Well, that's not a taking. You don't get anything for that. However, there has been a movement. It's built steam, and then it's disappeared over the years, that says that certain types of regulations that the government makes have the material effect of takings, in the sense that they remove economic value from my enterprise. As such, there should be a fair compensation for these kinds of regulations that take economic value away from my business. The Supreme Court has dismissed that, and as have other courts. They've just said, no, it has, if it's going to be considered a takings as per the Fifth Amendment, it must rob you, or not rob, well, maybe rob, remove from you substantially all of your economic value in the enterprise. Now, here's the upshot. This happened just a couple of years ago. The Supreme Court did something almost jaw-dropping. Since the beginning of time, since the beginning of our country, the take eminent domain has been recognized as being legal. It's in this Constitution. The government can take property from you for state purposes, for public purposes, certainly. Well, there was a case in which a city wanted to take by eminent domain some private property, but not for a public purpose. They wanted to take the private property so that they could give it to a developer to build a shopping center. You remember that one? The Supreme Court said, yeah, that's okay. And I mean, I am among the writers and analysts, policy analysts, who ask the deep constitutional question, WTF. Come on, what? This wasn't for a public purpose, this was for a private developer. Are you nuts? Their argument was, well, the private developer will do something good with the land and then we'll have better revenues and it will help the public because they'll have another shopping mall. Do you see the logic? I mean, the most contorted ass logic. So that's now constitutional law. The Supreme Court said this is okay to do it. It doesn't have to be for a public purpose directly. It can be if the public body that declares the eminent domain foresees that there will be some benefit to the public from transferring this to a developer, then it is an eminent domain that is constitutional. Yep.
Because Walgreens does all the prison medications or whatever.
That's right.
We just got a new juvie prison back where I was from in town. And they bought up all houses, but he wouldn't sell them. The government came in. And
sure. Just takes it. Sure. When did this happen?
Oh, that would have been early 2000s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It just went wild. One of the funniest things about the Supreme Court decision, though, it was quite disturbing because what had been considered to be more moderate, maybe center conservative justices, jumped on and said this is okay. It was like we saw this whole block of the Supreme Court moving right into the camp of Scalia and Thomas, and One of the Supreme Court justices we would not have expected to buy into this state authoritarianism, corporate state marriage, which is what's really scary to a lot of people, is we're seeing this marriage of a corporate and state. And I'll talk about that in a minute. But this one group actually started making plans to work with a city to declare eminent domain on the Supreme Court justice's house so that they could build a theme park or something like that, a hotel it was, on his property. So they've been trying to get his land to be taken away from him under this new doctrine that he got put into place. Well, of course, he just pissed all over himself. You should see the legal briefs his lawyers have been filing. Oh, it's okay if we do that to everyone else, but it's not okay if we do that to you. But this is exactly what you said we could do now, is take away property. So we're going to take away yours, and we're going to put a nice little thing that's much better than your house there. He of course, was outraged, just furious about that. I will give you a cautionary term, and I don't like where I am these days in the sense that I am a conservative. I'm an old-time conservative. Hell, I even defended Richard Nixon, you know, when he was being kicked out of office. Loved Gerald Ford. I didn't like Ronald Reagan too much, but I find myself in a very difficult position condemning the way things are right now in what has now become of republicanism and conservatism. But I'm compelled to do it these days, hoping to God we can get some of the old-time conservative Republicans back around, but I can't see any of them on the horizon. Do you know what the term is for a political system where the state merges with corporate interests? Have you been taught what the term for that kind of a state is? I'll bet you won't believe me when I tell you. That is technically, that is what we call fascism. Fascism is the marriage of the large corporations to the government in a commercial, industrial, military, political complex. In Nazi Germany, to give you an idea of how this worked, there was a massive dynasty of heavy industrial industries run by an ancient family called the Krupp family. As part of the early phases of the development of the fascist state, its linchpin was to get the Krupp dynasty to have the same sovereign immunity as the government itself has. Sovereign immunity means you can't sue the government. That's an ancient doctrine here, everywhere. So a law was passed in Germany. It was called Lex Krupp, the law for the Krupps. It essentially gave them the most important aspect of a nation state, the immunity from prosecution. That is what fascism is. It is a marriage. So that there becomes a difficulty distinguishing where corporations ends and where the state begins. This is what scares legal scholars and intellectuals, and I'll speak of for myself as being one of those. When you hear about the telecom immunity bill, so the government, the Bush administration wants retroactive legislation so that the fact that the telecoms were allowing their systems to be used to spy on you, to wiretap your cell phones, to wiretap everything you were doing. The Bush administration wants a law passed to give them immunity from lawsuits. That's a Lex Krupp. That is a law giving telecoms essentially the status of nation state in the sense of giving corporations, a certain set of corporations, the status whereby they are no longer answerable to the bar of justice through the judicial judicial review process. That is why there is a great deal of consternation about giving especially retroactive immunity to the telecoms. They essentially opened up their wire systems so that they could be spied on. when we started talking about the rumors that this was happening, and I was tracking it, I saw that email messages were all being routed through San Francisco. Others were saying, we're seeing bizarre routings. This shouldn't be happening. Why are they, what's going on? And then we started hearing the rumors that it was because that was where the central wiretapping facilities were, the government was using to read all of our emails. We started screaming bloody murder. They called us a bunch of conspiracy theorists. Oh, that's not happening. Come on. Well, it turned out, yeah, that was exactly what they were doing. They were spying on us. Verizon was, AT&T was. The only company that refused to join in with this was, does anyone know what the telecom that refused to was? QWest. Mysteriously, it wasn't that much later that the CEO of QWest was indicted on major securities fraud charges. Gee, isn't that coincidental? I won't go into that too much at this point, but I do want to revisit that as this goes along. And the reason is because, yes, as business people, it would be great if we were married to the state. But on the other hand, as a business person at the low end, which is where we'll be, that's not our interest. Our interest is in making money, making profit, doing it as much as we can, keeping the government off our backs as much as we can, not becoming nothing but the prostitutes of the federal government. But I will not get into that right now. What I would like to do is I'm going to take a break here, and then we're going to step back. I'll go through a little bit of substantive and procedural due process as laid out in the 14th Amendment. And then I want to finish that chapter on constitutional law by discussing briefly the concept of absorption. Very cool concept in law where the 14th Amendment actually absorbed state law into the protections of federal law. And that was a direct result. That was a direct result of the Civil War. It was also a direct result of problems that had happened after that. And it is essentially the culmination of the federal government's establishment of supremacy over the states. But we will take a break now, and then we will return. Before I forget it, I want to bring up this idea of when a search is legal and when it is not, with respect to detaining you and asking for certain ID, asking for permission to search you or search property of yours. The way that the Supreme Court had expansively understood, interpreted, and promulgated people's right against unreasonable search and seizure had many aspects, but one of them was a famous ruling called the Walkman ruling. It had to do with a black gentleman who liked to walk. He walked everywhere. Known to many people, he kept to himself and he just walked. He walked in his own neighborhood. He walked in other neighborhoods. He walked in white neighborhoods. And the police would stop him. And they would say, we'd like to see some identification, please. I don't need to give you identification. I have done nothing wrong, and I am not even doing anything that appears wrong. I am just walking. Well, this whole matter went to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court, using an old idea, said, leave him alone, for God's sake. He doesn't have to give you ID just because you want it, just because you think that a Negro might be suspicious walking in a certain neighborhood. Get off his back. That was essentially the Walkman ruling. To give you how far our country has gone, the Walkman ruling is no longer the law of the land with respect to such matters. We now have the Supreme Court allowing what are called Terry stops. A policeman no longer has to have probable cause for a warrantless stop and demand for presentation of ID, All the policeman has to do is show that there was a good faith belief that something might be wrong. I have been the subject of 4 Terry stops in the last 5 years here in this part of the country, specifically right in front of my own damned apartment, standing out at 1 o'clock. The first one happened, I was standing outside my own apartment, smoking a cigarette. There is no porch, there is just a sidewalk out to the parking lot. So I was standing in front of my place smoking a cigarette. A policeman comes up in his cruiser, using the intimidation tactic of shining the blinding light on me. He then just sits there shining it on me for about 5 minutes, and then he quietly, calmly gets out of the car and asks me if I have ID that I can present. I couldn't say no. It was a Terry stop. You know what his excuse was? Well, we had a call that there was a suspicious person in the apartment complex. The next day, I called the police station to ask about the details of the suspicious person call. They refused to disclose anything about their call logs from the night before. I must rely upon the good faith. They didn't have to disclose. He did not have to have probable cause. After the first stop, there were 3 more, the latest about 4 months ago. Same situation in front of my own apartment. All they have to do is show that it was they were acting in good faith. Not probable cause, which is a huge hurdle. Not even reasonable belief. It just has to be good faith. And it's always the same excuse. Well, we had a call that there was a suspicious person. Dude, I live in an apartment complex where everyone looks like a suspicious person, you idiot.
Is that what they use for those stops that they put up?
It is based upon the same doctrine. It is based upon the idea that the police no longer have to have probable cause to stop. All they have to do is show that they were operating in good faith when they stopped you. This is why I bitched so much earlier. Remember when I was yelling about the rule of law? The rule of law is breaking down because we are giving latitude to invade privacy to certain aspects of society, certain individuals and institutions that are not accorded to others. And that is where the rule of law begins to come apart. It used to be the case that if you were to have a right diminished, it's certainly in the Constitution permissible to diminish your right to privacy, your right to be secure in your papers and property and person. But it had to be a damned good reason. Probable cause is a high threshold. And there ideally was a time when courts would hold a police official, a policeman's or a law enforcement officer, other law enforcement officers' feet to the fire. Why do you want this? Show me that this court can faithfully execute its protection of the people and still allow you to diminish one citizen's right. That's ideally what should be going on. The Supreme Court has moved from Walkman to Terry, which shows the erosion from probable cause clear down to good faith. 14th Amendment. I brought up that the 14th Amendment contains the Equal Protection Clause. I want to make sure that you understand that. Read the 14th Amendment again if it's unclear. But there's also another part to the 14th Amendment. It reinforces due process. It actually goes beyond the due process rights recognized in the Bill of Rights. First, there comes about from the 14th Amendment the clear correlation of and distinction between procedural due process and substantive due process. Procedural due process rights require that you be given adequate notice and fair hearing. Adequate notice and fair hearing. That is procedural due process. Substantive due process goes to the core of your constitutional rights against unreasonable search and seizure and all of that kind of stuff. It makes it clear that you have both procedural due process rights and substantive due process rights. It is not enough that your substantive due process rights are protected. You must also be given due notice and fair hearing. It is not enough, on the other hand, that you be given due notice and fair hearing. You must also have your substantive, your essential constitutional rights recognized from natural law protected. Moreover, the 14th Amendment absorbs your due process rights under state constitutions into federal constitutional law. So the several states may give you this right or that right, may deny you this right or that right, but they all answer to the 14th Amendment of the federal constitution. So your rights may not be diminished under state law. Your rights may not be diminished under state law because whatever rights you have under state law are part of the body of federal law by the 14th Amendment to the Constitution. The 14th Amendment, again, absorbs your rights under state constitutional law into the federal Constitution. Well, I'm sorry, sir, but our state constitution allows the police to beat the shit out of you to get a confession. No. Okay. Sorry, but the federal constitution does not allow that. Therefore, your state constitution can kiss our asses. You are protected by this giant umbrella of the federal government. No, even if you are found, the police officers that whipped you 60 times with a nightstick are found not guilty at the state level, you still have rights not to be beaten, and those rights exist in the federal law, and the federal law will come down on those who beat you. Yes, it might have been okay for those police officers to have shot three unarmed innocent men, killing one of them, and have a judge rubber stamp it and say he didn't like the way the survivors presented themselves in court. They seemed to be awfully irritable. It was basically what the judge said. He didn't like their demeanor.
Based upon their previous criminal record.
You know what? That's another thing, too. Based upon your previous criminal record, you still have the right not to be shot dead.
Plus, those cops didn't know what their previous criminal record was.
That's right. Give it a rest. They just saw three Negroes and started shooting. And they... Now, probably it will take until the next administration before the Justice Department comes down on those cops. Well, there's not going to be action until then. But, I mean, you know, it's one of those things that you have to appreciate is that your rights are not diminished by virtue of the fact, and this gets into some complicated things, and you get liberals and conservatives arguing this constantly. Well, these people were criminals. They had crimes in their past. So certainly that should weigh into any decisions that have to do with their right to keep on living. Certainly it should have something to do with how the courts view them. They had criminal backgrounds. The argument on the other side, and I'm not going to lay, there's that validity on both sides of this. Yes, a criminal record does impact and speak to the character and quality of the witness. On the other hand, by virtue of the fact that you do grow up black in the inner city, you're going to be much more likely to have a criminal record. That's just the reality of it. So it's a balancing act. You have to look at both sides of it. But certainly, there is something to be said for having the right not to be shot dead just because you came out of a stag party at a strip joint. You know, I've wanted to be killed because I spent too much money on the Bear Bimbos. I wish someone would shoot me because I'd wasted $400 on ugly women. But at the same time, you know, it certainly wasn't the policeman's job to shoot me afterwards. It's difficult. It's a hard call. But at the level of a court, that's that thing about that lady justice and the blindfold around her. You still have the right to present your grievance before the court, and the quality of the grievance in some situations should not be diminished by the fact that you have a criminal past, and certainly shouldn't be diminished by the fact that you're a little pissy at people because you got shot, as the one man did who testified. But that's all neither here nor there. Let me step away from that before I start confusing myself with the arguments on both sides of it. At the substantive due process level, if there is a law that infringes upon your substantive due process rights, that law must be pursuant to a compelling state interest. Now, I am going to, as this course goes along, you'll hear me begin more and more to talk about reasonable state interests and compelling state interests. You will notice tonight, for example, that I used neither word the first time I talked about a state interest. In the Central Hudson test, I used neither the word compelling nor the word reasonable. What was the word I used there? Do you remember? It was the word substantial. Now, that bothers me to use it, but that's how it was presented in the ruling. More modern, although it's not, I'm not talking about 90s or even 80s, but in a modern framework, you will see that the courts will use, the Supreme Court and other courts, appeals courts, will use a test to see if a law is constitutional, to see if a law passes muster. Sometimes the court will use a test of reasonability of the state's interest. Other times a court will use a test of compelling nature of the state's interest. So sometimes a state law that infringes upon some right will be tested to see whether it is a reasonable interest. In other situations, the test will be to see if the law promotes a compelling state interest. Now, the 14th Amendment lays out clearly that with respect to substantive due process, the state's interest in narrowing your due process rights must be compelling. It can't just be a reasonable state interest that narrows your rights to vote, for example. It must be a compelling state interest. This is, again, I have to point out that this, I've taught this for a long time. Now I have to make a qualification because the Supreme Court just recently ruled in favor of a voter ID law. Now, voter ID laws have been really anathema to civil libertarians because they used to be used to keep black people from voting because black people in the South tended not to have an ID, and that was how you kept them from voting in elections. Well, you got to give a show an ID, a picture ID or an ID. Well, I don't have one. I don't drive. I can't afford a car. Well, I'm sorry, you can't vote. That was how the good old white boys in the South kept the Negroes from voting. Well, here we come. States started to say, well, let's see if we can try this now that we got a real right-wing Supreme Court. Let's start passing these laws again. We all know that there is so much fraud in elections. Well, yes, Florida was sort of that way, and Ohio was in 2004. Well, that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about this scourge of criminals and other people trying to vote several times in several different precincts. We know it happens all the time. Oh. Do you have any evidence that this is a major problem? Well, no, but we know it happens. So a couple of states passed laws. Sure enough, the Supreme Court said, we'll hear this. See, we will revisit voter ID laws. And then, of course, the question is, okay, we're talking about a law that impacts upon a substantive right, voting. Surely we've got issues about the Equal Protection Clause going on in there, too. Because we know that there are still more people who are of color who do not have IDs than there are wealthy white people. We certainly know that there will be a disparate impact of this law on voting by black people. So we go to the Supreme Court. This time the Supreme Court says, oh yeah, this is okay. The state has a reasonable interest, a reasonable interest in ensuring that the elections are not tainted by voter fraud. Look at the language of the 14th Amendment. Look at the language of the 14th Amendment. You are not illiterate. You are not stupid. And you now have the Constitution in front of you. Oh, isn't that interesting? So you see, teaching this course is a bitch anymore because the law is in flux. Things that I would have taught without even batting an eye. Established law is now under siege. Established law. We are going back and recreating law, some of it in the image of law that was ugly law of another era that we thought we had gotten away from. Well, here we are. So, what the hell? I don't want to go into this anymore. That's enough for you, for my purposes in this course. And this is a business law course. Important in regard to business law is that businesses, in one sense, a business does not have constitutional rights. But in another sense, yes, it does. Expansively considered, a business is a person, a business does have legal standing. Now, remember that standing to sue requires first that there is a case or controversy, and second, that there is a personal stake. And a business as a person certainly can sue if there's a case or controversy, and if that business has a personal stake. Notice how we are moving to the word person in terms not just of standing before the law, but standing with respect to a lawsuit, but standing under the law itself. Person applies to a business. Again, not always to the extent that an individual does. As business people, you will find that you can be abused quite a bit more by regulators than a person can. Even as much as individual rights are being eroded by Supreme Court decisions, by law enforcement officials. This has been going on for a long time with businesses. As a business person, this is what makes me a conservative. Hating regulators who are constantly doing things that they would never do to a person. Just marching into your business establishment, demanding things, looking at things, sticking their hands up your ass, taxing you, making your life miserable. This is part of being in business. Recognize that there are rights a business has as a person of standing under the law, but those rights do not have the quality, and in many cases not the character, of the rights that are accorded to human beings as citizens of this republic. Liberals will yell their heads off, well, businesses shouldn't be considered persons. That's ridiculous. Oh, but it is these same liberals who will scream their heads off for gay marriage being recognized by the state. You see, marriage creates a person out of two people. Marriage is a union that actually creates a person under the law. Our state and federal laws and our constitutions recognize non-humans as persons. Marriages are persons. So too are other things. So if we are going to expansively understand the concept of person with respect to constitutional law, we cannot, without some degree of disingenuity, distinguish between persons of one character that aren't humans and persons of another character that are not humans. So if we are going to recognize, for example, a marriage as a person, a couple as a person, as a single person under the law, we should certainly at least entertain that this same status, personhood, can be accorded to other non-individual citizen things as well. As a business person, the reality of this is that you will really, really not like the government sometimes. As I said, they can just charge into your business. They can demand things from you without court orders. They can lay rules on you without judicial review. They can make your life miserable. That's why, as this course goes along, you are learning business law as a subject separate from general law, general constitutional law. I move from constitutional law to the next subject through the gateway of the concept of the person, because you must understand that business entities can be persons with respect to the next subject. Individuals can be persons. Marriages can be persons. The next subject is contracts. Now, what I will do here is I will ask you if you will take a brief break so that I don't break off here in another 15 minutes. I would rather take this in one big chunk, and if you will do it this way, we will finish at about 8:25 this evening. Does that sound like a reasonable way to do this? 10-4. Okay, take that break, and we will do contracts when we return. Let me now go into contracts. Now, I will continue this on Monday, but here you will get the outline. A contract is an agreement that meets a four-point test. Now, the number of points varies depending upon whom you are listening to. For example, the book does 5 points. I consolidate 2 of those points into 1 point. There are some lecturers who will say contract meets a 6-point test, 12-point test. I use a 4-point test for a contract. And as I said, you will notice that the book actually splits one of my points into 2 points. You might see why I do it consolidating 2 of those points here in a minute. But again, a contract is an agreement that meets a 4-point test. And I always start off this lecture by asking the question, and I will ask it of you, madam, what is necessary for a contract to come into existence?
2 or more people have to agree on something.
Excellent. And that's exactly wrong. That's what I want you to say, though. Thank you. And I do apologize for shooting you down like that. First of all, it would be 2 or more persons, not people. Persons. But much more importantly, it is not an agreement that is necessary. It is a disagreement. Why would you need a contract if there's no disagreement? The contract codifies the resolution of actual and potential disagreements with respect to a transaction. A contract codifies any actual or potential disagreements pursuant to a transaction. The resolution of them, I should say. The resolution of those disagreements. That's why you cannot contract with yourself. There is no such thing as a contract with yourself. First, there are not 2 or more persons. More importantly, you cannot have a disagreement with yourself unless you have one of those split personality kind of weird-ass things, and even then, that's just creepy. You can't disagree with yourself in a legal sense. Therefore, you cannot construct a contract that would codify a resolution of that disagreement. Now, you will hear about these. You've made a contract with yourself to stop smoking. You've made a contract with yourself to lose weight. Oh, horse crap. No. You can have internal processes that want to do different things, and you might create some kind of silly agreement promising yourself that you'll stop. But in a legal sense, you cannot contract with yourself. And the reason you cannot is because you cannot have a legal disagreement with yourself. So there can be no real or potential disagreement whose resolution is codified or codifiable in a contract. Now, let me go to the four-point test. It is a contract if all of the following are met. First of all, there must be an offer and an acceptance. This is the one that the book splits into two. It says offer is one, acceptance is another. I call it offer and acceptance, and it's because there is a blurring here. This really is one thing, and I'll explain that in just a minute here. But let me go on to the other ones, and then I'll come back through these. Offer and acceptance is one. Two, consideration. And I will put in parentheses mutual. Thing of value for thing of value. Thing of value for thing of value. The third one is legality. The fourth one is capacity. And it is in this capacity one that I will be at substantial dispute with the book. And the way the book presents it could get your ass into trouble. Now let me walk back up through the list. Capacity. Are you capable of entering into contract? First, I'll tell you a case. Two couples lived next to each other down in the South. Every weekend they would get together and they would play card games and get drunk together. Really drunk. Well, one night they were at the one guy's house, one couple's house, and he's just trashing it. Ah, this place is a piece of crap. I'd sell this for a dollar. They're drunk. And the guy from the other couple said, I'll take you up on that. So this guy who owns the house, writes on a napkin, I hereby sell to Joe Smith this house for $1. Well, they laughed, had a good time. Joe Smith, not his real name, sticks the napkin in his pocket and goes home. Next day, he comes back over. Here's your dollar. Let me have the house. What? No. Yeah. We contracted. No, we didn't. That was a joke. No. Yes, we did. I got it on paper. Except it's a napkin. God. Besides, I was drunk. Come on. What say you? Valid contract or not?
I would say it was in breach because he wasn't in
breach. No, not breach. Would say it is a void contract. Void. In fact, no. Drunkenness in and of itself is not sufficient to render a contract void. No. And this is where the book and I are at disagreement. Because the book seems to give you the impression that if you are drunk or stoned, that somehow automatically makes you not responsible. Do not get that idea. You can be responsible for a contract into which you have entered under the influence of alcohol, under the influence of medications. It is not automatically the case that the contract is void or voidable. Just because you're drunk, just because you're stoned, just because you've taken a few too many Prozacs, it doesn't work that way. The law cannot work that way. Capacity is not automatically impaired by being under the influence of a drug or alcohol. Period. Moreover, the law is beginning, and there are still issues here. The law is beginning to recognize that people who were traditionally called some hateful term like retarded can't enter into contracts. Well, two people with Down syndrome, what we used to call two mongoloids, well, they can't marry. That's a contract, and they don't have capacity to enter into a contract. Well, that's just plain horse crap. The reason that people with Down syndrome used to be seem so stupid was because we thought they were stupid. We didn't educate them. We didn't teach them. We've got kids with Down syndrome who are growing up to go to college now. My God, I have seen it. It's amazing when you start treating people like human beings, what they actually act like. Well, by God, sometimes they act like human beings. Imagine that. Who would have thunk it? Capacity, being mentally diminished by virtue of Down syndrome does not automatically remove you from the right to enter contract. It might impair you in some ways, especially there are arguments, but what I'm trying to do is talk about the idea of the automatic voidability or voidness of a contract. Now, let me go here into minors. A contract with a minor is voidable at the discretion of the minor. A contract with a minor is voidable at the discretion of the minor. Get that down, and then I'll say the unless. No, not here. But bear with me. Let me finish. Let me do the qualifier. Okay, now I'll say it again, but I'll flow into the qualifier. A contract with a minor is voidable at the discretion of the minor unless the contract is for a necessity, in which case the minor does not have the option to void. A contract with a minor is voidable at the discretion of the minor unless the contract is for a necessity, in which case that discretion is not there. So, and I'll give you sort of an absurd example here. You have a salesman, and there's a 17-year-old kid. Car salesman sees a 17-year-old kid come in. 17-year-old kid walks in the door and says, I would like to buy that Lamborghini. And he actually comes up with the money for it. Pays the salesman. Goes out, wrecks the car, walks back in and says, I hereby void the contract. Please give me my money back. Now, that's an absurd example, but yes, theoretically, there is an argument that he may void it. It is a voidable. It is not void. It's voidable. Remember, notice the difference between the word void and the word voidable. However, the 17-year-old goes into a hospital suffering from a gunshot wound and says, I must have medical attention. And after they sew him up, dig out the bullet, sew him up. He then says, I hereby void the contract for these services in exchange for money. No, that was for a necessity. Now, let me take this down to the level of an actual case. A little bit idealized, a simplified version of a case. A young man, age of 16, lived with his parents. He had a major argument, a huge argument with his father. The teenager stormed out, left. Father said, fine, get out. Well, the teenager goes the next day to an apartment complex and rents an apartment, pays the down payment, signs a lease for a year. About 2 weeks later, he and his father reconcile, blubbering tears, and I love you, Daddy, I love you, my son, and all that kind of silliness, Hallmark moment. Well, then, of course, the boy calls the landlord and says, I herewith void the contract. Please give me my security deposit back. Tear up the 12-month lease. The landlord says, no. What's the landlord's argument? The contract was for a necessity. Shelter is a necessity. The boy says, or the boy's lawyer says, yes. What would be the lawyer? What would be the boy's argument? It never was, because he always could have gone back to his parents. The fact that he did shows clearly that he could have. So it was not a necessity. The question for you is, who would win in court? In suit at common law, who would win? would the contract be voidable or would the contract not be voidable? You see the argument on both sides? Difficult, isn't it? Interesting case. Capacity. We'll go back through these. We'll do a lot more with these as time goes along, but certainly this is a good first pass. It gets you to thinking about things. Legality. A contract cannot exist for illegal goods or services. So, that means that you hire the services of a lady of, shall we say, questionable repute. You order the Elliott Spitzer special. Is that a contract? Certainly not. But what if you signed an agreement that this money was for the purposes of friendship and companionship and discussion, and anything that would happen of a sexual nature would be outside of the contract? What if the contract, the document you signed, read exactly that way? Unless it was clearly the case that the contract was fraudulent in the sense that it misrepresented the fact that this really was for you to get ass, then it is not legal because the contract is a sham. The contract is clearly for you to get the good stuff, even though the contract clearly states otherwise. Let me ask you, I won't ask the ladies here this. Have either of you guys been to a house of ill repute? No. A whorehouse. Okay. They will tell you right there. You understand that we're going into this room alone for the purpose of adult conversation only. And that anything that happens other than that is merely consensual adult activity outside of what you are paying me for here. If anything else happens, it's just because we like each other. But you're paying me just for us to talk dirty to each other. And that's constitutionally protected. Yeah, that's how it works. Okay? And that means, first of all, that there is at least a thin veil of an argument for a real contract to exist. And it also is, at least to some extent, a protection against it being a policeman charging the woman with prostitution. Because she'll say, you and I agreed that this was you were paying me for an adult conversation. The fact that we went and had sex was because we liked each other. And I told you we wouldn't do that unless it was just because we liked each other. That wasn't what you were paying me for. That's the way that prostitution houses work. Well, there are, of course, in Nevada, prostitution is legal in most places, not in every place in Nevada. So you don't have to worry about that gaming on it. You may not contract for the purchase of drugs that are illegal. Buying drugs is not legal, and so there's no contract forming there. Great case from English common law had to do with a gentleman who sued his business partner because his business partner was conducting business without his knowledge, without his partner's knowledge, and was keeping the profits from these operations instead of sharing them as per the agreement of the partnership, and said I should want my partner to be ordered to disgorge half of his profits on these operations he did on his own to me, even though he did them on his own. We're in a partnership, so I get half of it. Well, as the court explored it more, it turned out that this partnership was a partnership of highwaymen. Now, do you know what highwaymen are? Highwaymen, that was the term you used in old times for robbers on the roads, highwaymen. They would come up in horses, and they would just simply accost your carriage or your horse and take your money. And if you didn't give it to them, they would kill you. If you did give it to them, they would just let you go on. Well, once the court determined that this was a partnership of highwaymen, Then he, or first of all, declared that there was no contract because it was an agreement for illegal activities. And then he ordered the plaintiff hanged and the defendant in the lawsuit hanged. So there's a lesson to you. If it's not legal, don't bother a court with the problem. Okay? Good lesson. Consideration. Thing of value for thing of value. And there must be an immediacy of the consideration. There's only one exception to that, and that's called promissory estoppel. I'll get to that in our lecture on Monday night. But for all intents and purposes, it must be thing of value rendered for thing of value in the context of the exchange of the immediacy of the agreement. Now, the thing of value can be money. The thing of value could be your work or an object. But there has to be thing of value for thing of value. Now, madam, I bought you a gift, so I should certainly expect, you took my gift, so I expect certain things. That's right, you will go bowling with me tonight. Is that a contract? You took my gift. No. No. No contract. You're blushing. I didn't mean to make you blush, but no, there's no contract because what happened was I gave that to her, but there was no expectation rendered that this was for something else. I gave it to her, and then I certainly expected her, but I did not tell her, you may have this gift only, this thing of value, only if you give me a thing of value in return. I didn't do it that way. Therefore, no contract. I give you this ring. Will you marry me?
I don't think we can in this state, can we?
Fresh. We'll go to California for God's sake.
Sure, why not then? Ah,
thank God. Well, you take my ring, a 1-carat diamond, and then you find another, and you keep the ring. And of course, I call, where are you? Where's my ring? You say, that's not your ring, that's my ring. No, we had a contract, we had an agreement. Well, we might have had an agreement, maybe, you know, arguably, perhaps, but there was certainly no contract. Well, I gave you a ring. Yeah, but I did not give you my hand in marriage. That was a gift. I'm keeping it. And I... Slut. Walk away. You see, it has to be timely and has to be understood exactly that these are in exchange for one another. The thing of value is an exchange for, and there has to be clearly the understanding that thing of value is for thing of value. Gifts are not a way to create contracts. Now, before I go any further here, up to offer and acceptance, I will lay out a few terms. I'm going to separate contracts into two different kinds in several different ways. Now, there are express contracts, and then there are also implied contracts. Now, an express contract would be of a verbal nature. Now, when I say verbal in legal terms, people seem to think that verbal means you say it. No, verbal could be written or oral. But an express contract must be one of those. It must be openly declared by both sides. We are entering into an agreement, a contract. However, that's not the only way a contract can form. A contract can be implied. There can be an implied contract by the nature of the situation. If I walk into a hair salon and I just sit down, and let's say that some lady, the hairdresser, comes up, hi, my name is Joan, let's take you back now. What would you like to have me do? Well, I should like a haircut and maybe wash my hair and have a haircut. Well, that's very nice of you, thank you. And when it's all over, I start walking out, and she says, okay, that'll be $45. Well, wait a minute. I was just sitting here, and you came up and asked me. I'm sorry, there's no contract here. Yes, there is. By the nature of what you were doing, where you were, and the context of the situation, an implied contract formed. Oh yeah. You do not have to express to cause a contract to come into existence. Implied contracts are all over the place. You walk into a McDonald's or into a Wendy's or into any fast food place, you order food. You are opening the negotiation for a contract. Neither of you is going to say, whereas we, the parties to this said agreement, are entering into this agreement, wherefore, and blah, 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 and legal clause one, legal clause two, whereas we have witness to this contract. No, you don't do that, but it surely is a contract of high quality. That should tell you something. First of all, that's an oral contract as opposed to a written contract. And that's our next one here, oral versus written. And it is an implied contract as opposed to an expressed contract. Notice, by the way, now that I'm moving over to the oral versus written, notice that oral contracts can have every bit as much quality as written contracts. In fact, in your lives, the number of oral contracts into which you enter, that you execute, will far, far, far exceed the number of written contracts into which you enter and into which and through which an execution is accomplished or a breach is made or some other way of terminating the contract happens. Oral contracts are all over the place. And again, they are far more common than written contracts. The number of written contracts you enter into in your life is actually, if you thought about it, you could probably number them on a couple of hands. Your contracts for employment, your contracts for your credit cards, contracts for a mortgage on a house, maybe a contract for a car, a loan on a car, those kinds of things. But every day you're entering into oral contracts day and night. All through your life, you are entering into contracts of an oral nature. Yeah. Oh, interestingly, I have to think about that because that kind of violates that mutuality, the immediacy. I guess you could argue that there's a promissory estoppel in there. That's an interesting one. I never thought about that. That's actually kind of cool. That's interesting. Let me give you this last breakdown, and that'll be it for the evening. Bilateral versus unilateral. Now this one, I always do this one with an example. Oh, with actually two examples. And I see if you can see, catch the difference between a bilateral and a unilateral contract. I will give you $50 and you will wash my car. I will give you $50 if you will wash my car.
The and the yes?
Uh-huh. You see, in one of those, there's only one promise. And in the other one, there are two promises. Do you see it? In the unilateral contract, there's only one promise. In the bilateral contract, there are two promises. And each of those two promises must be fulfilled. I will give you $50 and you will wash my car. That means that you have to wash my car whether or not I give you the $50. If I don't give you the $50, I'm in breach of contract. But if you don't wash my car, you are in breach of contract because it was bilateral. There were two promises in that contract. You promised to do something for me, and if you don't do it, you're in breach. I promised to do something for you, and if I don't do it, I'm in breach. But in this one, if you don't wash my car, I don't have to give you $50. One promise versus two promises. Bilateral versus you. Believe it or not, if you catch that, that drives people crazy. The difference between bilateral and unilateral. So, now, let's try this one. Go back. We're almost finished here. Okay, go into the McDonald's. And you're the burger girl today. And you say, may I help you, McPlease? Well, McYes, I should like a number 10 and supersize me. And you ring up the bill, and you see that, say that'll be $7.99. And then you lean over, number 10, supersize him, he's a fat boy! And it comes down the chute, ka-thung! You grab it, crackle, crackle, rustle, rustle, and you say, McHere's your McDamn dinner. And I say, McThank you. And I eat my food, and I McBurp, and I McLeave. Okay. First of all, I'll tell you what it is that expressed or implied? Who made the offer? You or me? Yes. Oh, wait a minute. That doesn't make sense. It's McDonald's. They made the offer. They had the sign. No, I made the offer. I shall pay you a certain amount of money. Bilateral or unilateral?
Unilateral?
Yes. I shall pay you the money if you give me my McDinner. Unilateral. Unilateral. I'm not going to get my dinner from you unless I pay you. But once I pay you, you must give me my McDinner. You see, first and foremost, advertising does not constitute an offer. Believe it or not. Just because you've advertised a number 10 for $7.99 does not constitute an offer. It is not specific enough. You say, wait a minute, it tells exactly what you're going to get. Yes, but it doesn't tell me how many of them I'm going to get. It leaves that open to me. So when I order, the fact that I am tapped to be the one who tells you that it is a number 10 I want and how many of them I want means that I am the offeror. And you, as a representative of McDonald's, are the offeree. That's all I have for you this evening. I thank you.